Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. This is Wednesday, October 14th, 2009. And I want to welcome you if it's your first time. If you want to get on my email list for the sitting group, or you're on my general list and you want to get on the list for the sitting group in particular, there's a yellow pad with a pen back there next to the donation bowl, which is sitting conspicuously on a half pound of dark chocolate, which is going to make my wife very happy. And next to it, if you're interested, are little flyers for my book, which is actually printed. And it'll be in bookstores and a convenience store near you by November 1st.
And I went into the internet and you can pre-order on Amazon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So I'll deluge you with marketing messages shortly about it. But anyways, if you want to see the flyer for it, it's kind of neat. And it's pretty cool to get it, actually. So. Yeah, I'll do something about that. They're going to do an event at Spirit Rock for it on a Friday night, January 15th. And so, anyways, what? January 15th on a Friday night. Yeah. But anyway, I want to welcome you. I'm very psyched about tonight's topic. As a prelude to getting into masculine and feminine in a larger context of using relationships this year, as both a field of practice, in other words, a place to practice in, and also relationships as a mode of practice, if you think about it. I think, how can we do that without touching on, of course, masculine, feminine? Not just in terms of gender, least of all, probably in terms of gender, men and women, to the extent those categories even mean anything, but masculine, feminine, you know, within each of us. So as a prelude to that, somewhat inspired by the emergence of the feminine historically in Buddhism about 500 years after the Buddha's death, which I'll talk more about next week and have a handout for you about. One of the main thrusts of that was really, I think, to bring a balance back in to, in other words, in a teaching, in a wisdom tradition that was so focused on transcendence. In other words, almost leaving the earthly plane. The aim being, arguably, in some ways, to become so disengaged with involvement in life as to just sort of float away. You know, a healthy balancing to that was a focus on embodiment. And around 500 years after the Buddha died, and an emphasis on embodiment as an embodiment of wisdom. Isn't that interesting? We often think of the body as sort of crass. Within a Judeo-Christian tradition, it's sort of crass and animal, and you know, wisdom is up there, hell is down here. And the notion was that if you're not really embodied, you can't be deeply wise. I think of it a little bit like the analogy to a kite. For a kite to soar high, the string has to be tethered. If you let go of the string of a kite, the kite will flutter to the ground. Isn't that an interesting metaphor? It's that tension that actually enables the kite to soar high. So as an entry into that, long story short, I thought that tonight we could explore the actual embodied experience of both compassion and loving kindness and the ways that they, first of all, feel in your own body in different flavors, and also how they differ for you and your body. If we have tons of time, which I doubt, because we never do somehow, I don't know why. Anyway, we can maybe also do the embodiment of the other two Brahma Viharas, in other words, the other two sort of lovely, divine, and you know, awakened places to be, namely what's called sympathetic joy, you know, happiness for the good fortune of others, rather than envy at their good fortune, and then also equanimity. But for sure, compassion and loving kindness. So that's the plan, my plan at least. And we know, of course, what plans are subject to, right? Change. Okay, so, but meanwhile, before we dive into that, let's see, I wanted to see, as we usually do, is there a question or a comment about meditation, either tonight's meditation or meditation in general, or anything? And then we'll dive in. How was it for you to do the counting? I mentioned doing counting as a way to stay present with breath. It's a great method, but it's a basic method, but I think like a lot of basic methods, it's great to come back to it from time to time. You know, or you count each complete breath up to 10, you start over. Anybody try that? I did, I know that, it helped. Did it help? You know, you stay for, sort of grounded in the breath. Yeah, it's a good method. Another one is to count down from 10. I think that actually helps people stay a little more alert because we can go on autopilot sometimes counting up to 10. And another one is just sort of to note softly in the back of your mind what the actual sensations are. You know, in, out for the breath, let's say, rising, falling. Any one of those methods are fine. Okay? Any other questions or any questions or comments other than my own? Okay. How's your alertness level tonight? Mine's a little mellow. I've been working so hard. I just had a good night's sleep last night, but I'm still kind of like catching up. How about the rest of you? A little alert, good, energized, sort of. Okay, we'll find out. All right, maybe we should pass that chocolate around. Maybe. How about we share the Donna? What a good idea. So next to the donation bowl, is that okay with you? You won't object, will you? How about? All right. Trust, like, would you be willing to do the honors? Crack the thing, it's under the basket there. Meanwhile, we'll pass around the Buddha's words on loving kindness. You know this drill. Everybody grab one, if you will, unless you brought your own. I keep copying them. So open it up, if you'd like, break off a chunk, a little caffeine in chocolate, a little sugar, a little sweet, a little energy. Good stuff. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm just projecting. And I want to actually eat it. It's a polite way to get my own. You know, share it with you first, right? Okay, everybody get one of these things? So just as a background for those of you who don't know, this is one of probably the most famous teachings of the Buddha that have been handed down over 2,500 years. This is the Sutta on Loving Kindness. And what we've been doing lately here is just going around the room, usually a couple of times, and everybody reads a line. If you want to skip, it's perfectly fine to skip. Just look to the person next to you. Maybe what we'll do is we'll start with me and then go to my left, come all the way up here, pick up the three people in the center there, and then we'll keep going again. How's that? Okay? One way to read this is not as some kind of sacred text that has a kind of scriptural quality. I mean, we could, but we don't have to. But to actually read it as an instruction manual, as coaching tips from a master of his craft. All right? So let me get my little just desserts here. All right. Come back to you in a minute there, big guy. Okay? So I'll start. And by the way, sometimes it's fun to be aware of which line you get, right? You can kind of think, oh, what does this mean to me? It's like the fortune cookie effect, somehow, or the horoscope. You actually could have mixed them up that day, you know, and you're really a Libra and someone else is an Aquarius and swapped them, but you still find meaning, right? Okay, here we go. This is what should be done.
By one who is skilled in goodness.
And who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright,
straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited,
unburdened with duties and approval in their ways,
peaceful and calm and wise and skillful,
not proud and demanding in nature.
Let them not do the slightest thing
that the wise would later reprove.
Wishing in gladness and in safety.
May all beings be at ease.
Whatever living beings there may be,
whether they are weak or strong, omitting none.
The great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen,
those living near and far away.
Oh, sure.
Those born and to be born.
May all beings be at ease.
Let none deceive another.
Or despise any being in any state.
Let none through anger or ill will
wish harm upon another.
Even as a mother protects with her life,
her child, her only child,
should
one cherish all living beings.
Radiating kindness over the entire world.
Spreading upwards to the skies.
Go downward to the depths.
Outwards and unbounded.
Free from hatred and ill will.
Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down.
Free from frozenness.
One should sustain this recollection.
This is said to be the supreme abiding. By not holding to fixed views. The pure-hearted one having clarity of vision.
Trisha?
Being free from all sense desires.
If not born again into this world.
Always makes me happy to hear that. It is, the whole thing's great. So, any comments on the line you got? Any comments on the particular line you got? And if not, it's perfectly fine. I'm just, sometimes something strikes a spark as a personal meaning to you. It's perfectly fine. Yeah, Steve.
Sometimes you're just trying to move through the rhythm and not listening to the words. The words are really sinking in.
Yeah.
It's kind of a rhythm to each.
There is one. There is a scriptural quality. Yeah, you're right, but you try to.
It's kind of musical after you hear it a couple of times.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, Betsy.
Well, I like the idea of the fortune cookie, so I'll go with that.
Yeah. Good.
The humble and not conceited reminds me that we're all in this together.
Yeah.
And no, I'm no better, and I'm also no worse.
Thank you.
Just a little piece of that.
Great. Perfect. Beautiful. Yeah.
Actually, there is one line in Cavalline, which is radiating kindness over the entire world. And I went to hear Michael Beckwith speak last night.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about how he was speaking in the Nokia auditorium. And how he was beginning to, he did a national TV show, so he was focusing on the people in the stadium and the people in the rooms of the outer part of the stadium and the people enjoying the building and then the people on the street and then the buildings beyond and how he was able to do that. And it's very interesting, this thought about radiating kindness to other people.
Yeah.
And how our spirits don't really have a sense, are not bound by time or place.
Yes.
You know? So then he had to focus on how he could talk to the person in Iowa because it was a national TV show.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, so
thank
that you. That just kind of struck a chord with me.
Yeah. Yeah. I once heard Sylvia Boorstein on that note do this, do a loving kindness meditation, and then she's a teacher at Spirit Rock, and. She just started calling out. She said, loving kindness for someone fishing in Nicaragua. You know, loving kindness for someone working in an office in South Africa. You know, loving kindness for a child laughing in China. You know, loving kindness for someone dying in Nebraska, right? Loving kindness for someone being born in Alaska. Loving kindness for, you know, someone giving birth in Australia, whatever, you know what I mean? It made it incredibly real, just these concrete people, just because that's what it is around the world. And that's who we radiate kindness to. It's easy to get abstract about it, but there are real people out there. There really are real people. Homespun, homegrown, real people. Yeah. All right, yeah, please.
It wasn't my line, but every time I read this, I look at may all beings be at ease.
Yeah.
And I think about that for the people often, but not enough for myself. So when I read this, I really feel coming into myself that, you know, I really do deserve to be at ease and in a place.
Mm, that's really great. That's great. It's like, what happens in the body when we feel at ease? Like, do you feel a change happen when you imagine being at ease? Yeah, I do. At ease. Thanks. That's great. Yeah.
That was my line, and it really struck me as well. I led a short little meditation at work this morning, and mm-hmm. one of the administrators was answering. Well, I used this idea of ease, and it was it was powerful, you know, in my own body, and then I think in hers as well. But, I just wanted to say, I also went to Michael Beckwith last night, and I was just stunned at what a channel he is. He gets up on stage, and without any notes, he just like is streaming in information for hours. And he's an amazing channel, I think, as a popular figure, you know. Yeah. Messages to humanity.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, he seems very kind to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In his quality. So that's great. Anybody else?
I just mentioned, I got two lines, you know.
Great. Fortune first cookies,
one,
great.
The first one was, I read, was by one who was skilled in goodness. And of course, perfect. A perfect match for me. But the next one is, or despise, let none despise any being in any state. And all day today I've been suffering from being wronged by three different things. So I'm looking at these things. See, here I am, a good, innocent person. Not I mustn't despise any being in any state. Those who have wronged me. So it was pretty cool.
That's a double whammy. Bam, bam. That's a good one. That's great.
What'll I do tomorrow morning? Is the question.
Yeah. Well, that's what we've talked about a lot in here, which is to not despise others, you know, not be caught up in ill will. First and foremost, because it's an affliction on ourselves to be caught up in despising or ill will. It feels bad. It's the opposite of ease. We make mistakes that come back to haunt us. You know, people define karma as hitting golf balls in a shower, right? They come back, right? That's what happens when you're ill will toward other people. It, you know, it harms you. And then it also harms other people, which then ultimately comes back to you as well. But on the other hand, there's a complete place for being absolutely discerning, clear-eyed. I mean, we've talked in here a lot about that. And to be, in effect, precisely because you're not swept away by ill will, you're not clouded by anger, right? There may be anger there, but it's kind of out in the bleachers while you're in the playing field. It has a distance from you. Okay, you're not swept away by it. And that enables you to see clearly, like, you did wrong. Whoever that is over there, you know, or that wasn't cool, or that actually was against the rules here, or I see you. I see you're not someone who keeps her agreements, and I'm not going to make other agreements with you, or whatever. You know, there's a place for discernment and gravity, and a discernment that's consequential. You don't have to give up your discerning faculties. If anything, they're more powerful when you're not upset. And actually, they really land, you know, when someone sees you clearly. And they're not upset, but they're willing to call it the way it really is. Doesn't it have an intensity to it? Not like they're doing anything to you. It just kaboom. Like, ooh. You know what I mean? Right? It's very important to imagine the combination. You know, just because we're peaceful with others doesn't mean we don't see them clearly. And we don't take care of our own needs. Or the needs of others that we're protecting. Okay. And you can even wish people well while simultaneously thinking that it's appropriate for justice to be served in different ways. Yeah. I wish you well, and you can't come here anymore. You know, I wish you well, and you violated the terms of your, you know, kind of work probation. We're going to have to let you go. Right? Or people who shout me nameless, I wish you well in jail. That's where you belong. Okay, any comment on that? Someone had their hand up? Do you see?
Okay. Yeah, it's very empowering.
Yeah.
Because I'm easily subject to guilt, and just the way you talked about that just made me feel guilt-free. That just being discerning and kind-hearted at the same time, and protecting myself.
Yeah, please.
If you're being discerning, oftentimes the other person's going to be upset. I mean, it's really hard not to get caught up in that. You know, if you're calling it as it is, then you take it another phone.
Right.
And they get upset. It's really hard not to get drawn into it. Even if originally you started out being very objective.
It's very real, isn't it? So that you're naming the truth, and so let's suppose, obviously there's a lot of questions, is it really the truth? Let's suppose it is the truth, okay? And you name it, and they don't like that you named it. So they maybe counterattack, and they go after some detail in what she said that was not exactly correct, or they go after how you said it, or that you did that yourself last year or something, right? You know, that stuff happens, correct?
Or just the fact that you said it, you know, that you brought it
yeah.
to the surface.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can talk a lot about that, and we have to some extent done that, and it's very real, isn't it, to do that. I think of the, you know, the Buddha's suggestions, really, in terms of what constitutes wise speech. It's well-intended, so it's sort of like a pre-flight checklist. Before you launch, ask yourself, is this well-intended? Is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? Is it not harsh? For sure those things. And those are a good strategy to reduce the odds of a negative reaction, right? And then, ideally, is it wanted? So, but let's suppose you fulfill all those, right? And the other person still gets reactive based on what was said. And then what do you do from there? Well, first off, are you in your body when it's happening? To pick up on our theme tonight of being in the body. Are you in your body? In other words, right? Because sometimes when people are reactive with us, we just kind of go away from our body. We stop feeling, our breathing tightens, we start breathing shallowly, say, we're frightened, we get a little dissociative. It triggers us about other people, maybe parent figures, maybe authority figures, maybe ex-husbands, ex-spouses, ex-wives, you know, who would get mad at us, and right? So it's important to kind of come back and claim, I get to be here. And to use the metaphor, I think it's a nice one, it's the Buddha on the myth or the true whatever account of the night of his awakening, where he just sat there and he said, I get to be here. You know, he touched the ground, he felt it was okay to be here at the base of the tree, and faced by all these sort of demons and illusions and distractions and seductions and all the rest, and he said, I get to be here. So I think that's a place where we begin. I get to be in my body, I get to be here saying this thing to you. We kind of take our seat, stand our ground. I think part of what enables us to do that is our sincerity and having done those five things, and hopefully six, before we launch. You know, good intentions, it's true, it's useful, it's not harsh, and it's timely. Right, that helps us really stand our ground and know our good intentions. Make sense? And then another one is to have compassion for them and you in this moment. Doesn't mean you're waving your right step compassion for them. You can just look at them. They're suffering. You look over there, and it kind of helps stay present to see the other person is suffering. Right? You can see they're getting upset. They're wounded. You can see beneath their anger, you know, beneath their case, is just pain and reactivity. That also is a good thing, too, rather than getting caught up in their words. It's kind of funny, like, it's very powerful to not care what they think and to see that the thoughts that are flying through their mind or the words they're using are not really what counts. What they're just there to serve a function, like to make you go away or punish you for ever daring to speak up, right? And if we take them at face value, it's like you think about the pronouncements from different press secretaries for different governments or different pundits. It's easy to get caught up in the words. It's not about the words. It's about the function the words serve in other people. And so you kind of see through that, too, because you're compassionate. You see through that to the person who's upset and just reacting. And you see for yourself. It's not your favorite thing to have somebody upset with you. All right? So right there, what does compassion feel like in your body? You know, if you just imagine, you know, compassion boiling down to the wish that they not suffer, right, and that their suffering end. Like, what's that feel in your chest and the inside of your thighs, in your back, in your face, when you wish someone not suffer? So just imagine that for a second, if you could. We're going to do something in a second with this. Right? What's compassion feel like? What's the embodiment? What's the embodied experience of compassion like? Right? And then another part is, let's suppose you can manage some kindness for them, where you wish them well. You know, kindness being at root the wish that they be happy. So compassion, you wish their suffering end. Kindness, you wish that they be happy. They be truly happy. I like that word, truly happy, because it gets past the superficial stuff, and it gets at a kind of a, almost spiritual happiness. May you be truly happy, truly contented. Like, I grew up in L.A. I went to Disneyland, I don't know, maybe 20 times before I was 20 years old, because we'd have relatives come to town, they'd take us to Disneyland. I knew how to sneak around Tom Sawyer's Island and hide and get in the cool places and stuff like that. And having spent a lot of time at Disneyland, the happiest place on earth, right? That's the big sign. As I got older and older, I started looking around and I started looking at all the faces. And most of the people there past roughly the age of 10 did not look happy most of the time. And those past the age of 20 looked very unhappy, especially if they had young children. And it wasn't what you call truly happy, or even if they're gleeful. You look at them and go, are you truly happy? You know, that's where we're at. That's where we're wishing for people. So, right there. What's the embodied experience of kindness? Of feeling kind toward other people. Sort of wishing that they'd be happy. Maybe wishing that they'd be happy far, far away. You know, out of your house, out of your life, out of your office, whatever. But that you wish they'd be happy. You wish them well. What's that feel like in your body? Yeah. Notice the difference? I mean, so let me make a comment, and then let's segue into a brief little experience, if you're willing. And like any experience here, you can always step out of it or opt out. The comment I have is what to do when you say something to people and they're reactive with you. So let's suppose that you've done what you can at least to get prepared to say it. You've thought it through, you're kind of grounded, you know what you want to say, you meet the five conditions, and still they're upset with you. One thing that I have found that really works is to focus on what my own self-interest is in the situation. In other words, what's my goal? What's my mission? My prize. I try to keep your eyes on the prize. It's so easy to get distracted when other people get reactive. And ask yourself, what's the prize here? Maybe the prize simply is that you said it. Like, sometimes there are key people in our lives, like our parents, perhaps, or an important person, and we just want to say it. One time. We don't even need to say it twice, because we know in our heart we're on record having said it to them. And they can do whatever they want with it, and we're not going to get drawn into that, because we did say it, and we know that they know that we know that they heard it. See what I mean? And that's all we do. And very often, I've been in situations where people sputter and sputter and sputter, and validate it and deny it and all the rest, but you know what? They act differently the day after. You know, it did land, actually. So you want to ask yourself, what's your prize? Maybe your prize is that you really want to discover what's actually true. You know, that's a different prize. And the point is, whatever the prize is, know what it is, and often I find it really works to just stay on topic. Just keep coming back to the point. And in particular, drilling down to either what is the fact, you know, that you see, or in particular, what is the agreement you want to get from now on? And often that's the real prize. Because if you're trying to get the person to agree with you about the past, it's often really difficult. I speak as a guy who's been in a room with a lot of couples quarreling about the past. And the past is really hard to agree about. Once in a while, you have to really come to terms with the past. But more than much, usually, what it's really about is, I just want to know that from now on, it's basically going to be like this. Is it or not? Right? And that's the prize. That's often the real prize. The future. The undiscovered country. What's going to happen from now on? See that? And then, depending on the nature of the relationship, you just come back to that. What's going to happen from now on, and what needs to happen so that that thing happens from now on. And very often, what emerges is if you want X to happen from now on, they need Y from you for X to happen. So then it's in your self-interest to figure out what Y is so that they'll do X from now on. More or less, well. Doesn't have to be perfect usually, but more or less well. Does that make sense? Do you see how that works? And then you just keep coming back to it. A story that for me really pops out is, I don't know if you ever saw the video of Richard Pryor live on the Sunset Strip. Did you ever see that one? It's really funny. You're nodding. Maybe you saw it. I don't know. This was right after Richard Pryor, who's no longer alive, African-American comedian, was smoking crack, and the pipe blew up. It burned him very badly, so he ended up in the hospital, also on drug charges. And, so he goes through rehab, he comes out, and this is his first public performance. And so he did this really wonderful back and forth with Jim Brown, the football player, actor, and then kind of youth advocate. This, you know, Jim Brown's a huge, formidable guy, really. And so the point is that Richard Pryor is doing this thing on stage. It's a one-man thing. So he's playing Richard, and he's playing Jim Brown. And so he's playing Richard before the crack pipe, and then he's playing Jim Brown talking to him. So it kind of goes like this, and think of how this is relevant to what happens when we speak truth to people. So Richard, who I'm a bad actor, but he goes to Jim Brown, "Yeah, man, it's cool, it's just drugs, you know, it's whatever, you know, no problem, you know, hey, you want some?" And then the Jim Brown voice, "Richard, what you gonna do?" "Oh, I'm fine, don't worry about that. Why give me so much attitude, man? You know, I'm really okay. It's like whatever. It's the white man that's trying to keep us down, keep us oppressed, you know, he's trying to deny us pleasure." "Richard, what you gonna do?" "Oh, you asked me again that question. I don't know. I mean, I'm fine. Why do you keep asking me that question?" "Richard, what you gonna do?" So you're like in about six of those cycles, you know, and that was it. Jim Brown just kept coming back to the point. "Richard, what you gonna do? Richard, what you gonna do?" And there's something profoundly powerful about that simple gravity that just is, right? It's that, it's discerning. Jim Brown wasn't criticizing him. He wasn't lambasting him. He didn't despise him. But he was absolutely clear. What are you gonna do? Right? And I think that stance is a very powerful stance often. We say it in different ways, softly, you know, intensely, loudly, quietly. But that's kind of the bottom line question, isn't it? Often, that's what we want to know. What are you going to do from now on? And if they thrash and twitch and the rest of it, you know you aren't sure what they're going to do. In fact, you don't think they're going to do it. And then you have to figure out what you're going to do as a result. Yeah. That's a great one, to yourself, too. What are you going to do? Are you going to get, you know, whatever? Are you going to yell at the kids again? Are you going to hit the dog again? Are you going to have one glass of wine too many again, or whatever? What are you going to do? All right? So let's do a little thing, if you don't mind. A little experience here. Embodiment. So in a moment, what I'm going to ask you to do, if you're willing, grab a partner, and basically the way this will work is this. It'll be short, so we have some time to talk about it. One person will be speaker, one person will be listener. So you pick an A and a B. We'll just keep it simple. A's will be the speaker initially. A's, for 2 minutes, talk about some situation in your life that has importance to you and difficulty and you know, kind of woven together. It's important, it's significant, it's difficult, it's challenging. There's opportunity maybe not, but there's definitely, it's got you. It's important, it's significant. And for the first minute, B's, just listen and focus on compassion. And it's really okay if your mind gets distracted a little bit, caught up in what the other person's telling you, or you go away. But as much as you can, keep coming back to giving compassion to that person. And, pardon me, notice what the embodied experience of compassion is. And then I'll ring the chime after 1 minute, and then A will keep talking, and B will then shift over to kindness. What is loving kindness like? The wish that they be happy. The wish that they find true happiness. What's that? And again, keep thinking about, what's this feel like in my body? This is like a mindfulness practice. So you're both aware of what they're saying to you, but you're also aware, it's divided attention, you're also aware of the feeling state of compassion or loving kindness inside you. Okay? And then I'll ring the chime again. And for just 1 minute, talk about what that was like for both of you. In particular, what it was like to feel, what it was like for B to feel compassionate and kind. And then did A notice anything? Because obviously A is noticing that whether they're getting compassion or getting kindness. What's that like? All right. And then we'll switch roles and then we'll talk about it. Okay? So it'll be about 6 minutes total. 3 minutes one way, 3 minutes the other way. And so try to, bear with me and just kind of move it along. Yeah?
Kind of hard to separate compassion and loving kindness.
Try to find the difference. I think you'll be surprised, possibly, by discerning a real difference. You know, compassion is very moved by empathy. You know, by moved by empathy for their pain, their sorrow. Compassion focuses on the pain, the sorrow, the suffering, the fear, the anger, the difficulty, the challenge in the other person, right? Whereas kindness doesn't require that. Kindness can just help them to be happy. Kindness focuses on the bright side, how good it could turn out, how well it could turn out. Yeah?
Are we speaking or just feeling?
You're just feeling it. You're listening mainly. It's okay to ask a question to keep the flow going, or particularly if there's something you're wondering about. But mostly, if you're a listener, focus on just the embodied experience of compassion or the embodied experience of kindness. Okay? Want to try? Okay, grab a partner, if you will. It's okay to sit it out and pick an A and a B. If you don't have a partner, raise your hand. Right behind you, Tarde, yay. Do you have a partner you want to sit it out? Good. Okay, grab a partner if you want. Pick an A and a B. Okay, everybody ready? Everybody got a partner? Everybody set? Okay, so A's and B's. B's, you're going to be compassionate. A's, you're going to be talkative. Begin. Shifting to kindness, keep going. Wrap it up. Okay, if you don't mind, debrief for 1 minute. What was that like, and especially what did you notice about compassion compared to kindness? Begin, please.
And who should go first, the A's or the B's?
Oh, the B's are mostly talking about this one. But you can both talk back and forth. Please wrap it up. Okay. Get ready to switch roles. So A's, you're going to be compassionate while B's are being talkative about something challenging or difficult. See how that works. Okay? Ready? A's, be compassionate. Begin. Shifting to kindness. Keep going. Please wrap it up. Okay, and now take one more minute. A's talk about, especially A's, but back and forth, about what it was like to be compassionate and kind. Begin. I felt that Please wrap it up. And come on back. All right, come on back. How was that?
Interesting.
All right. So how was that? Somebody said interesting, somebody said all right. What did you notice especially about the embodied experience of compassion and kindness? Yeah, Harold, did you want to say anything?
Well, before we started, Cynthia remarked that it would be clear about the differentiation between the two, and I was in the same place.
Yeah.
I've never done it. So we did this, and Kitty discovered it was very active to be compassionate with it, going across and things coming in, whereas loving kindness was basically irradiating. So that worked. It was very clear.
Wow. Great. Thank you. Okay, great. Tarne.
Well, Betsy and I worked together, and I think we kind of agreed on the two feelings, too. Compassion was more a sense of grounded, a real sense of being very grounded so that a space of holding without judgment could be created. And then, but the kindness, I felt like really like a physical feeling in my chest, my heart, where you want to engage it somehow. Like,
we wanted to touch
each other, you know, hug, cry. I started to tear up and, you know, get engaged in an emotional kind of heartfelt sense with the kindness portion of it.
Okay, thank you. This has exceeded my wildest expectations. That you could get such a differentiation, in effect, of the different states. They're on a spectrum, of course, but still, there is a difference. Yeah.
I think compassion is really listening. When you listen with someone, you are compassionate. If you really listen to what people are saying, you get involved in what they're saying. You you're compassionate.
Thank you. Great. Yeah, great.
In the compassion part, I had to actually remind myself, compassion, and then go back into it. And so that was something I had to work with. When it came to the kindness, it was right there. I didn't have to think about that. You know, I had this image of pouring water over a coach, you know, the football game in the winter.
Oh, right. Gatorade. It's yellow water. That's great. That's really great. Yeah, Ruth.
I experienced compassion as, in my body, I experienced it as spaciousness. And that was really a nice feeling. I think it's probably from a human condition that I can take on people's, especially people's distress feelings very easily. And my boundaries are not always real great. So just to Bill and I work together and I also had, in addition to the meditation, I had acupuncture massage that afternoon, so that may have helped. But I just felt very, I could just in my body, I felt spacious, I guess that's all where I came from. And for kindness, it was sort of the opposite of what you were saying. I felt the kindness in me, but yet I felt detached. I felt caring, but I just sort of saw him as another person. I felt a little bit less engaged somehow, but still loving. Yeah, so very interesting.
That's great. Yeah.
I felt that the loving kindness was very easy, in part because I detached myself, and I'm not sure I was really listening that well. But I felt a real warmth, and with the compassion, kind of felt like I really had to get into it, and it was sticky, and it was difficult for me. So the loving kindness for me was kind of where I turned out my mind, I guess. I don't think I went about this correctly, but
oh no, that's great. Yeah, good. Hey, Donna.
It's like the love and the compassion is coming more from the head, and the kindness feels like it was coming more from the heart.
Although some people might have...
might switch it, right. The compassion was really listening and understanding, yeah, and letting the person know in whichever way that she was being heard. Yeah. And the kindness was just the felt experience.
Hmm, got it, yeah.
I go with that too. And you, I agree with the word listening. Is, it's about listening. I say getting behind the other person's eyes and in, inside the other person and kind of trying to get behind the face that's speaking to me.
Yeah. Harold, and then I'm going to ask you a question, and then let's move toward a wrap. Yeah.
Well, as I was listening, compassion said, what I found was I was briefly triggering the same emotion that was being described, or emotion that I could imagine arising as a result of what he was describing going on in your life. So it wasn't just listening, it was listening plus having the, it's like the mirror.
A lot of empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of mirroring, as it were. Yeah. So what was it like to bring awareness into the embodied experience of listening and being with the other person, especially the sort of compassion flavor of that embodied experience or the kindness qualities of that embodied experience? But grounding in the embodied experience, yeah, please. Like a vehicle in the first place, right? That's what you mean by instrument, kind of moving through you?
Being a vehicle for something. For the listening. So you become an instrument of the peace, an instrument.
Right.
And then with the kindness you become, you recognize an action.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's hugging, you know.
Right.
Or
thank you.
Something that you can do.
Yeah. Thank you. As it has an effect. It's channeled to a purpose. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, please.
I think compassion to me is akin to uplifting matter elsewhere. I mean, you be compassionate to someone or to a situation and you help uplift them through compassion. Where kindness is really is your own transmutation. I mean, you radiate love and kindness, and you know, that's your own transmutation. Where compassion is an action in the world, seemingly to uplift matter in the world, uplift you know, someone else's situation.
Mm. Yeah. One thing that strikes me about all this as first the diversity of experiences, and second, the appreciation of so many different ways to have positive states of mind, particularly directed toward other people, right? These are all, I don't think anyone here would say it was an unpleasant or negative state of mind to have. And it's nice to appreciate that there are a lot of different ways to experience a positive stance toward others in a felt kind of way. Which goes to my kind of last question, which is, when you think of love and compassion or kindness and compassion as modes of practice, in a practice that seeks to suffer less and to become increasingly free of the causes of suffering, do you feel more or less beset by the causes of suffering now than when you did this exercise 10 minutes, when you began this exercise 10 minutes ago?
Less.
Probably. Anybody else feel more beset by the causes of suffering than they were? Probably not, right? Isn't that interesting? That is a practice of personal liberation and entanglement from the causes of suffering, that by being compassionate, being compassionate and kind is a vehicle to that purpose. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said so eloquently, yeah, can I say more?
And if you knew that you were the instrument and the way to uplift that suffering, then when suffering came to you, you would, both for yourself and for someone else, then you would see it as an opportunity, and all of a sudden the joy comes in, and it doesn't have the weight of the suffering anymore.
Yeah, isn't that? Thank you. So well said, yeah. It's paradoxical that actually by entering into the sorrow over there, joyfulness increases, in a way. You know, it's a very heartfelt joy sometimes, or a bittersweet joy, but, you know, there's a good feeling that arises. How about we sit for 1 minute or so, just to kind of marinate in this, and then we'll wrap up for tonight. May our efforts help free all beings from suffering and its causes.